Matthew 26, I want to try and make some headway tonight, but I feel compelled to deal a little bit with Gethsemane again. I tried to deal with some of it Sunday, unsuccessfully as far as I'm concerned. I want to say a little bit. I'm going to try not to spend a lot of time, but some of the things I didn't have time to say or didn't say, and some probably that I did say, so we'll just kind of see what happens. Matthew 26, verse 36, "Then cometh Jesus with them into a place called Gethsemane, and saith unto the disciples, Sit ye here while I go and pray yonder." Jesus is about to have the battle of his lifetime as far as this walk in this world. The devil, I believe, realizes something's happening. He can't tell the future, but he knows, he sees circumstances, he knows what Judas is doing, and he sees all that's going on, so he knows that the cross is getting closer. He's going to do the best he can to stop Jesus from going. If he can't stop Jesus from going to the cross, he's going to try and keep him from raising from the dead. And of course, he failed there too, thank the Lord. But Jesus is about to endure the fight of his life. I said this Sunday morning, Jesus and his fight. He is fighting with the devil. He is fighting with evil. It is literally as though heaven and hell are fighting against each other. The devil is putting out all his weapons and all that. Can you imagine? There's no telling what the devil did. I don't think he held back anything. I think when the battle was over, the devil said, "Well, I did my best," and he did. And Jesus faced this battle with victory, thank the Lord. The word Gethsemane means oil press. It has that idea of pressing the oil out of the olive. It presses it down that the oil might be extracted, and that's exactly what Jesus is about to go through. He is being pressed beyond measure. What a blessing it is that he was willing to do that. And he tells his disciples, "Sit here while I go and pray yonder." He is asking them literally to realize there's something going on. And there's something about to happen. Verse 37, "He took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, and began to be sorrowful and very heavy. He left the eight," probably at the gate or at the opening of the garden. We don't really know that, but somewhere. "And took the other three, James and John and Peter, on a little further," and then he'll be leaving them in just a second. But notice what it says. It says he began to be sorrowful and very heavy. Sorrowful means distressed. It actually means depressed. It amazes to me. We see the humanity of Jesus here, I believe, like nowhere else other than maybe the cross. But we find him here as the man that he was. He was perfect and sinless, there's no doubt. But the word literally means also sad. It has the idea of dissolving. It is as though the strength of Jesus is dissolving away. Even the life of Jesus is dissolving away. This is a real battle. It says that he was very heavy. It literally means to be engulfed with grief. Mental and emotional distress, completely surrounded, has the idea of that word or those words, heavy, very heavy. No part of Jesus is untouched. Nothing about him, his humanity or even the God side of him, the devil's doing all that he can. The intense emotional and even spiritual conflict. There's no other human that has faced what he faced there in that garden that night. Verse 38, "Then saith he unto them, My soul is exceeding sorrowful, even unto death. Tarry ye here and watch with me." He speaks now to the three disciples. And boy, he opens up himself. "My soul is exceeding sorrowful." It means intensely sad. When I think about that, I don't even think about those kind of words connected to Jesus or God. You think that they're above that, untouched by those things. But then we need to realize God does have a heart. Even the God the Father has a heart that's touched. He, if you will, gets sad. He gets burdened. He is troubled. He is grieved. And the son certainly was that day or that night here in the garden. He was intensely sad, and he warns the disciples through his words, "My soul is exceeding sorrowful, even to death. Tarry ye here and watch with me." Once again, he says to his disciples, he's asking them for help. Now notice what he says, "Tarry ye here and watch with me." He says, "I'm going to be watching, but you better be watching." Remember who he's talking to. He is talking to those who he had just said literally a few minutes earlier, "Tonight." He said, "Tonight you're going to be scattered. Tonight you're going to be offended." It looks like they would have thought about that. When he said, "Tarry ye here and watch with me," they should have said, "Boy, you remember what he said just a little bit ago? He warned us about something that was going to happen, and he said it was going to happen tonight." And they should have prayed with him and stood with him and watched with him. Again, all the forces of hell is about to be unleashed. And unless Jesus gets help, he's in trouble. And surely the disciples are. Thank the Lord that there is help to be had. Notice, "My soul is exceeding sorrowful, even unto death." He literally said, "I am about to die. If I don't get help, this is going to be the end." The devil was trying to kill him. And had the help from God not arrived, it would have happened. Now, we know it couldn't have because God is God. But this is a real battle, that's what I'm trying to say, because that's exactly what it is. Never before, as far as I can tell, remember, did Jesus ask his disciples for assistance. He asked them to do things and to go places and to help in the handing out the bread and all those things. But as far as helping him, Jesus in his fight, but then also Jesus in his focus. Look in verse 39, and he went a little further. He always does. Jesus always goes further. He does more, goes further, gives more, sacrifices more. And he still is, by the way. And he fell on his face and prayed, saying, "Oh, my Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as thou wilt." I said this Sunday morning, I said again, you got to start that verse at the end to understand exactly what he's saying. The ending of the verse, the ending of the words, the ending of the comment says, "Nevertheless, not as I will, but as thou wilt be done." That was what he was settled with the entire time he was at Gethsemane, the entire time he was on earth, the entire time he was in heaven before that. He said, "Father, your will be done." But it was difficult. And he said he fell on his face and prayed, saying, "Oh, my Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me." Now we need to realize he was not trying to avoid the cross. He was not trying to talk God the Father into a different way. What he was saying is this: if there is another way, I'll do it that way. But he is in essence saying there is no other way. The only way for forgiveness is me dying on the cross. I know that, and I'm willing. There is no other way to get to heaven than trusting Jesus Christ in that finished work of Calvary. So he had to die. He knew it. The Father knew it, and so do we. But he said it. He says, notice, he's praying. Notice, he fought his fight through prayer. He fought the fight by getting on his face before the Father. And he was successful in the fight. And he is telling the disciples, "You need to join with me." He's going to say that specifically in just a minute. You need to join with me. What is he saying? When you have a battle, the way to get through that battle is to pray through the battle. Our biggest failure, I'm convinced, is the failure of prayer. The battle is won or lost in the prayer closet 99% of the time. And there is a battle even in getting into the prayer closet. How many of you find it easy to pray? If you do, would you write a book and let me read it? I'll buy one, I promise you. It's difficult to pray because there is a battle, and the devil will do his best to stop us from praying. He did these disciples. Jesus fought his battle through prayer. Notice what it says. He was completely and totally committed. Said again, he was not trying to avoid the cross. He said, Father, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me. But nevertheless, not as I will, but as thou wilt be done. And we know he was no other way. We see the humanity of Christ. Flawless and sinless and imperfect. But he is struggling. He is in agony. That shame and that pain and what's ahead on the cross. Could have said it like this in human terms, it's overwhelming him. We also see the deity of Christ, the God side of Christ, because that sin he's about to take upon himself grieves the holiness of God. And notice what he says there. Oh, my Father, be possible, let this cup pass from me. I mentioned Sunday that cup means it involves sin. Jesus, when he hung on the cross, my sin and yours was put on him. That grieved him. He's just thinking about that. He's looking ahead toward it and knows it's about to happen, and it grieves him. It burdens him because he is God, and it burdens him. He took our sin on him, all the sin of all the world, the sin of Hitler and Stalin and Mussolini and Saddam Hussein, the sin of the child molester, the sin of the drunk, the prostitute. I said again, like the sin of the Wall Street executive who thinks he doesn't need God. All those sins, all that sin was put on him. And it was in that cup. That's the bitter dregs he had to drink. It was the bitter dregs of sin. It was the bitter dregs of suffering. He suffered emotionally. He suffered physically. He suffered spiritually. The word, listen, the word excruciating comes from these words, from the cross. It reminds us how excruciating the pain was. Pain that no other human had endured because the devil was involved with trying to hurt him as much as he could. If he's going to the cross, I'm going to make him suffer like nobody else has. And that's what he did. All of hell was fighting, emotional suffering. Oh, this cup contained the dregs of sin and suffering and sorrow. All the weight of Adam's sin and Israel's sin and Judas's betrayal and Peter's denial that's about to happen to the disciples that's about to run and hide. The Father's anger and my failure and your failure and people who could be saved and won't be saved. All that's on him. He's thinking about it. And he's emotionally distraught. It does not mean he's out of control. Don't misunderstand me. The dregs of sorrow, the dregs of separation. When he hung on the cross, God the Father had to turn his back because God cannot look upon sin. Jesus took my place. It's like the Old Testament sacrifice. The guilty party would bring a sacrifice into the priest, and the priest would lay his hand on that sacrifice and slay it. And that placing of the hand of the priest was in essence a transfer of the sin of the guilty party onto that innocent sacrifice. And Jesus, as he hung on the cross, God the Father laid his hand on the Son, transferring our sin upon his Son. Now, he never did become a sinner. He did not receive our sin. He did not become our sin, but the sin was upon him. Just like that lamb that died, he didn't become a sinner. He became a substitute. And that's what Jesus was. He died in our place. He died for us. Listen to me. Jesus obeying the Father by going to the cross meant that he and the Father would be separated. Never before and never since does obeying God separate you from God. But it did that time. No wonder Jesus was having such a tough time, to say it lightly. His fight and his focus is on the cross. But then Jesus and his friends, look in verse 40. When he cometh unto the disciples and findeth them asleep, and saith unto Peter, what, could you not watch with me 1 hour? He comes and he speaks to the three disciples, but he addresses Peter for them all to hear. I said again, these were the same disciples who had just said, we'll die for you. We will die for you. And they can't even pray with them for an hour. They've gone to sleep. His friends were not too good of friends unless you're missing it. They failed him miserably while he was fighting the devil. They were all sleeping. You see, they had gotten accustomed to Jesus being there. I think one of the worst things that happens to us as Christians is that we get familiar with things. Get used to church and used to the Bible and used to preaching and used to singing and used to the Lord, and we take him for granted. And it may just be that God has to do something to rock our boat to wake us up like he does here, to where we appreciate his grace once again. They had come to this place many times before at the Garden of Gethsemane, and they'd understood, they had enjoyed it so much. It's been such a wonderful place, but something's different this time. And they needed to do what Jesus was doing, pray. Notice what it says. Saith unto Peter, could you not watch with me 1 hour? He says that to all three disciples. You know what I find in that? He did not excuse them. They were weary, they were tired, they were worn out, they were sorrowful, the Bible says. But Jesus still did not excuse them. He did not say, oh, fellas, I understand. You have had a rough few days. You need sleep. And I got a feeling if they don't get excused, neither do we. Oh, I know things are rough sometimes and things are difficult sometimes. And the devil does fight and we do get tired and weary. But if they didn't get excused, neither do we. Jesus says to us, couldn't you watch and pray with me 1 hour? Look at verse 41. Watch and pray that you enter not into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. He told them in verse 40 what they need to do. Pray. He tells them in verse 41, why? Watch and pray that you enter not into temptation. He said, the devil is after you. Watch. They should have been watching. Had they been watching, they would have seen there's something different, fellas. Jesus is distressed. Jesus is concerned, and they should have heard him praying just about probably 50 or 60 feet away. They should have heard the agony. They had been watching, they would have seen something is different. Boys, we better stay awake, stay alert, and pray with him. For ourselves. Had they been watching and praying, they would not have fallen into temptation and failed that night. He said, watch and pray. He tells us how to deal with problems. Watch, stay alert, know the devil's fighting, and pray. Jesus knew the way to victory, and it worked for him, it'll work for us. He noticed what it says, the Spirit is willing. God puts in the heart of every believer a willingness, if we'll let it, if we'll pay attention to it, a desire. And these disciples, listen, they had good intentions. If you will, they were willing. They said, and they meant it, we'll die for you. And they had good intentions, they intended to, but listen, they misunderstood good intentions for strength. They may have had good intentions, but they didn't have strength. They didn't have power. Good intentions are great, but it's not enough. Because Jesus said, the spirit is willing, the flesh is weak. You need more than just good intentions. You need strength from heaven. See, our old flesh still craves the things of the world. Our old flesh will never get any better. It'll still be there till we leave this world and go to the next. Look in verse 42. He went away again the second time and praying, saying, oh, my Father, if this cup may not pass away from me, except I drink it, thy will be done. Now, he really doesn't ask a question here. He makes a statement. Oh, my Father, if this cup may not pass away from me, except I drink it, thy will be done. Here he comes back the second. He's back in the place of the garden where he prayed for the second time. He's praying the second prayer, and he's praying along the same lines, but different. Now, the first prayer was, if it's possible, show me the way and I'll do it. But now he's saying, he's not requesting at all. He's saying, and more or less he's saying this, since it isn't possible and there isn't any other way, I'm willing to do it. That's pretty much what he's saying. He's, if you will, he's progressing in his prayer. And notice what it says in verse 43, and he came and found them asleep again. That tells me something. They were asleep again. So that tells me when Jesus came back the first time and they were sleeping, when he started speaking to them, well, they woke up. So they heard his words. It wasn't like he was sitting there, talking to people asleep and they didn't hear his warning. They didn't hear the distress in his voice. They woke up when he spoke, when he came back the first time from praying, and they went back to sleep again. In other words, it's like they're getting a second warning, a second alertness, and they go back to sleep again. But I wonder if we wouldn't have done the same thing. He came back and found them asleep again, for their eyes were heavy. They were tired. I don't tell you, have you ever been so distressed that you were worn out, but you still couldn't sleep because of that pressure of what was bothering you? That's where they should have been. They should have been so overwhelmed, like Jesus was, with what was going on that they couldn't sleep. Luke tells us a little bit more. He says they were sleeping for sorrow. That means they were so grieved about what was going on that they said, I just got to get some relief somehow. So they went to sleep. That's a part of it. But here's my point, and here's Jesus' point. Instead of staying awake and praying and getting help and getting strength, they went to sleep and were defeated. They missed what they could have had because they went to sleep. Verse 44, and he left them and went away again and prayed the third time, saying the same words. So he went back the third time. Could I mention something here? He prayed the same thing more or less three times. I don't think it's wrong to ask the Lord for something more than once. Now, if you're praying vain repetitions, the same old word, oh, Lord, please, oh, Lord, please, oh, Lord, please, oh, Lord, like you think that's going to make God hear you, Jesus said, don't do that. But asking the Lord for something more than once is not bad. In fact, he tells us, keep on knocking, keep on seeking, keep on asking. So there may be times you need to ask more than once. And unless he tells you to quit praying, he won't be grieved about it. Unless it's just absolutely a lack of faith, then that's a little different. But he instructs us here about how to handle problems. He says, pray. Found them praying the third, or sleeping the third time. So we looked at Jesus and his fight and his friends, or his focus and his friends. Let's look real quickly. I'm trying to get through, but I don't want to leave out everything that's on my heart. Jesus and his Father. I'm glad Jesus wasn't completely alone there in that garden that night. Luke gives us something that Matthew doesn't mention. Luke 22, verse 43, there appeared an angel unto him from heaven, strengthening him. Luke also tells us in Luke 22, 44, that his sweat became like drops of blood. The sweat glands and have blood vessels around them, and under extreme anguish, rarely does it happen, but it has happened before. Those blood vessels can burst, and there can be sweat mingled with blood, and it's because extreme anguish, and that's what happened to Jesus. And you know what that means? If something doesn't happen, Jesus is going to die there in the garden. If he didn't get some help. But like I said, Luke 22, verse 43 says, there appeared an angel unto him from heaven. God the Father sent an angel, and I don't know what he did, but he strengthened Jesus. He helped him through the night. It didn't end the battle, but it aided him in the battle. And Sometimes that's what Jesus will do with us. That's what God will do. He won't take the battle away, but he'll help us in the battle, help us get through it, and that's okay. He gives us grace enough. Sometimes grace enough is just enough. Just enough, but it's enough. And that's what grace is all about. Sometimes it's just overwhelming grace. My goodness, just flood your soul. Sometimes it's just enough to get through, but it's enough. And that's good enough. Troubles are going to come. There's no doubt about that. But whether we pray and watch and trust and believe and obey or not, we'll determine whether we're victorious or not. Verse 45. Then cometh he to his disciples and saith unto them, sleep on now and take your rest. Behold, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. He comes back for the third time. They're asleep again, and he says, sleep on. I said this Sunday, some people say that that means that Jesus let them sleep for a little while. And that's possible, but I don't think that's exactly what he was saying, because he says, sleep on now and take your rest. Behold, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is betrayed into hands of sinners. And the next verse says, arise, get up. I think what he's saying is, go ahead, fellas, if you want to sleep that bad, just stay asleep. Just go ahead and doze through the rest of your life. Just stay asleep spiritually. You know why? Because, you see, he's in essence saying the battle's already over. I've made it through with victory. It's too late to pray for me now. It's too late to pray for yourself now. And notice what he says. The hour is at hand. The Son of Man is betrayed in the hands of sinners. Judas has already made the deal and gone and got the soldiers and the religious leaders, and they are on the way, as we'll find out. And then lastly, Jesus and his fight and his friends, his focus, his friends and his father, but Jesus and his foe. The one who claimed to love him is the one that betrayed him, Judas. The one who said, I'm your friend, was really his foe. Look in verse 46. Rise, let us be going. Behold, he is at hand that doth betray me. He said, rise up. It ain't time to sit down now. Get up and let's go. There's something to be done. And I believe he says that to us in this difficult day that we're living. He says, don't give in to your emotions. Refuse to be defeated. You've been defeated right here. I'll tell you right now, you lost the battle in this garden and Gethsemane experience. But get up and go on, he said. Do us well to realize that when we fail, we better not stop. Don't let it get to you. Keep on. Get up and go. And Jesus fought and won. Then we start in verse 47. About the betrayal and the arrest and the suffering of Jesus. Verse 47. And while he yet spake, while he's talking to the disciples and saying, arise, the one that's going to betray me has already done it and they're on the way. While he's speaking the words, here they come. And while he yet spake, Judas, one of the 12, came with him. And with him a great multitude with swords and staves, from the chief priests and elders of the people. You notice, Judas, one of the 12, he makes sure that we know who it was, that nobody else is wrongly accused. It was Judas. Yes, one of the 12. Are you sure? Surely one of his own would not have forsaken him and betrayed him. Yes, it was Judas, one of the 12, that one that walked with him and said he was genuine and he loved the Lord. It was him. He's the one that betrayed him. It says he came with a multitude, the temple guards of the Sanhedrin, the leaders of Israel, Roman soldiers, John 18 tells us that. I would encourage you to read Mark 14, Luke 22, and John 18. You need, boy, it just gives such insight of what's going on here. They had these guards, this brigade, this group of soldiers that watched over the temple area, especially during Passover, and they came to arrest Jesus. They were taking care of the temple, but they arrest the Son of God. It didn't make sense. But they saw him as a disruption to their system. They were heavenly arms, swords, and staves. The John 18:3 tells us they had lanterns and torches. I can't imagine. It was a full moon that night because it was Passover. But even in the light of the moon, you could see those torches coming through the distance. Oh, what a, hey, it was, just the soldiers was about 600. John tells us it was a band of soldiers. That's about 600 people. Hey, it was a large group of people coming to arrest one man. And if he hadn't willed it so, that wouldn't have been enough. Verse 48. Now he that betrayed him gave them a sign, saying, whosoever I shall kiss, that same as he, hold him fast. How ungodly Judas was. How inconceivable this is. There needed to be a sign to where Judas could point out which one Jesus was to make sure there was no confusion. Not somebody that looked like Jesus or someone that the disciples had put in there to be a substitute, but somebody who knew Jesus needed to point out to these soldiers exactly who Jesus was. And listen, he could have just pointed at them. He could have walked up and just tapped them on the shoulder. But Judas devised this plan, the one I kiss, a kiss on the cheek. It's a sign of affection and love. It's a sign of humility to kiss on the hand or the cheek. It was a sign of the one that's doing the kissing, of humbling themselves to someone that's superior. Talk about a hypocrite. Talk about a hypocrite. Judas comes and kisses him. Whosoever I shall kiss, that is he, the same as he. And notice, hold him fast. I want to say good luck on that one, Judas. Except for one thing, Jesus was going to let them hold him fast. Hold him fast means overpower him. Judas said, you better really be prepared because I've seen this man do some things that were really unusual. And when you get him, you better hold him fast. He had seen Jesus raise the dead, calm seas, open blinded eyes, feed a multitude with a little boy's lunch. And he knew this one thing, this man can do unbelievable things. So fellas, when you get him, hold on to him. You ain't never had a prisoner like this one. I said again, had Jesus not surrendered, the whole world couldn't have held him. The kiss of an enemy. Someone has said rightly that Judas kissed the door to heaven and went to hell. Luke 22 verse 48 says, that Jesus said to Judas, Judas, betrayest thou the Son of Man with a kiss? It's personal. There's communication between him and Judas. It wasn't like he kissed him and ran off. One-on-one, eyeball to eyeball. Judas did it and walked off. 50. Jesus said unto him, friend, wherefore art thou come? Where you been, Judas? What you been doing, boy? I want to say that stabbed Judas's heart because he knew where he had been. He'd been betraying him and brought the people to arrest him. But I can't say that. Judas was so hard, it may not have touched him at all. The average people, the normal person, it would have smitten them in their heart. To him, Jesus say, where you been? What you been doing? And then came they and laid hands on Jesus and took him. Notice what he said. Jesus said, friend. It means comrade. Wherefore art thou come? That was the last words Jesus spoke to Judas, as far as we know. And I believe tonight Judas is in hell hearing those words. Where you been, Judas? What you been doing? But notice, then came they and laid hands on Jesus and took him. Tell you what, that's a miracle right there because Jesus allowed it. There's a calmness about Jesus now. He has accepted it. Not that he was resisting or refusing, But he's come down to the point where he's just moving on to the next scene. And he lets them take him. John tells us that when the crowd comes up, Jesus said to the crowd, John 18:4, "Whom seek ye?" Talking to the crowd. And their reply was, "Jesus of Nazareth." And here's what he said, "I am he." And the Bible says in John 18:6, when he said, "I am he," they went backward and fell flat on their backs. Just a little bit of the power of God. It was released. Wonder what if Jesus just said, "Poof!" He could have disintegrated the whole bunch without any trouble at all. But he just let a little power out, and they fell. It looks like they would have gotten up and said, "I don't know about you boys, but I am going home. If this man's got this much power, I ain't messing with him. I am going home." But the devil pushed him on, pushed him on, pushed him on. Luke 22, verse 49, while this is going on. Look in verse 51. "And behold, one of them which were with Jesus stretched out his hand and drew his sword and struck a servant of the high priest and smote off his ear." I want to say, "Way to go, Peter," but I can't. Luke 22, verse 49 says that the disciples, while this is going on, the crowd comes up. Jesus said, "Whom seek ye?" They say, "Jesus of Nazareth." He says, "I am he." They fall down. They get back up. And during all this process, the disciples say to Jesus, "Listen to me. Lord, shall we smite with the sword? Is it time to fight? Does this mean the battle's starting? Is the kingdom finally going to begin?" And Peter didn't take time for Jesus to respond. He pulled his sword out and whacked off Malchus' ear, is what John tells us in 18:10, that it was Malchus' ear. Luke tells us it was his right ear. Verse 52. "Then said Jesus unto him," put away thy sword into its place, for all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword." Oh, we're not told in Matthew, but Luke 22, verse 51 says that Jesus healed the man's ear. I've often wondered, did he reach down and pick up the ear he'd cut off and stuck it back on there? Did he make another one magically appear? Not magically, but supernaturally appear? I don't know. But I know this, whatever was wrong with his ear wasn't wrong when Jesus got through with it. And he said to Peter, "Put away your sword into its place, for all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword." Now, what he is saying is one thing, you reap what you sow. You fight with the sword, you're going to be fought against with the sword. That's one thing he's saying, but that ain't the real thing he's saying. What he is saying is this, Peter, there is a law. God had established government. He had given the law, and part of the law, listen to me, in Exodus 12:14, Leviticus 24, verse 17, Deuteronomy 19:21 said this, "If you shed man's blood, the government has a right to shed your blood." And Jesus is saying to Peter, "Peter, if you kill that boy, the government's going to have a right to come after you and put you to death. If you live by the sword, you will die by the sword, an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth." So he's saying to Judas, "You better look and see what you're doing, dummy." Then verse 53, "Thinkest thou that I cannot now pray to my Father, and he shall presently give me more than 12 legions of angels?" It just seemed like a calmness settled in because he surrendered completely. And he said, "Peter, don't you realize if I just look toward heaven, my Father could send me right now 72,000 angels. In fact, he could have sent a whole lot more. He just makes a statement. In other words, he's saying, if I choose, and we know he wouldn't, but he could have, but we know he wouldn't. He's God, and he said he wouldn't, but he could have. He said it. We know he wouldn't, but he could, because he said it. He says, in essence, I am not being overcome. I am not on the losing end here. I have not lost my power. They are not in control, Peter. I am in control. Then verse 54. But how then shall the scripture be fulfilled that thus it must be? He said, Peter, I'm here to do what my Father said to do. And he told us a long time ago what he would do, what would happen. And I'm here to do it. This Bible you got in your lap, you can trust. It's forever settled. Jesus said, I am just doing what my Father said I would do. And all this is a part of his plan. You're a part of his plan. You're a part of his plan. There'll be battles. There'll be difficulties. And we make it through those battles and difficulties by watching and praying, trusting and obeying. Did you hear me? Watching and praying and trusting and obeying. Four very quick blurted out words, but it means the world of victory or defeat, losing or winning. Let's stand together. Thank you for listening.